Looking for a fabulous fashion brand that celebrates you? Then look no further than Boston Proper, where styles are designed with you in mind, so you can look and feel amazing, no matter the day, season, or occasion. At bostonproper.com, you'll find fashion that knows you best. For over 30 years, Boston Proper has been the fashion destination for confident women who want to elevate their look with unique, sophisticated clothing at affordable prices. Visit bostonproper.com today. Boston Proper. Wear it like no one else.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbionica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or toxins. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbionica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbionica.com. Symbiotica.com.
Oh, hi, hello, and welcome. This is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and I am that host of yours, that woman who likes to use the word hecatonchires as much as possible, because it's too good. I'm Liv. Well, well, well. If I'm not here with a conversation not only about monsters, but quite specifically about volcanic monsters, sure, we talk all Greek mythological monsters, but we focused on the volcanic ones and volcanoes broadly because they are super cool. And I got back from Santorini last month and I'm so full of volcano content, I just had to let it all out. I spoke with Jasmine Elmer, a classicist who has her own podcast, Legit Classics, and who appears on UK television to talk all things ancient, though I think usually Rome, which, don't worry, we do have a fun little squabble about because you all know how much I prefer the Greek. Now, Jasmine and I were pre-existing friends on Twitter and are both super casual people, which I think really comes out in this episode. It's seriously fun, a little rambly, but in a good volcanic sort of way, so you don't have any reason to complain. Plus, monsters, spooky season, the whole thing. Ugh, we had so much fun. Conversations, the monstrously volcanic breath of the Chimera, Monster Myths with Jasmine Elmer. So today we're talking about monsters. So tell me why monsters were like the topic you suggested, and who is your favorite, or what do you want to rant about?
Oh my god, how long we got? I mean, why monsters? That's such a, do you know what I mean? Actually, I'm come at this at an angle I don't think you people will expect, but it's not going to make much sense, but bear with me. I have always loved geography. I know you're like, why are you doing classics? But I've loved geography. And I love the natural world. I love particularly hazard geography, right? So when I was looking at classics from the point of view of geography, I was thinking, what's going to be cool? What's going to be interesting? So I thought, what's one of the best things on the landscape? I thought, volcanoes. They're wicked. I mean, I'm from East London, you know, we don't have them knocking around our landscape, and there's none in England, but I've always been fascinated by them. And I thought, why don't I combine this fascination with what the chuffing hell? Chuffing hell is a very British thing, do you know what I mean? Like, what the hell? I don't know if you know these words, but what about when I take something completely insane that I'm interested in, like volcanoes, and see where it crosses over with classics? And that's when the monsters appeared, because I know you've already spoken to people about volcanic monsters. But that's where it came from. And I thought, monsters are actually cool, and they mean loads more than I thought. And I went down that rabbit hole, and I'm still in it, and I'm not coming out.
I don't blame you. I don't blame you. Volcanoes are a huge thing for me. My sister is obsessed with volcanoes. And so actually, like, I just recently came back from a trip to Greece where I brought my mom and my sister for the first time. Well, for the first time since 2005. So I'm counting it as the first time. But we went specifically looking for volcanoes. So we stayed on the island of Milos and then Santorini for the volcanic purposes. And my mom really needed to see Santorini. But honestly, I mean, that's all to say. Volcanoes are just the absolute coolest things in the whole world. And the fact that they would link them up to monsters is just the best.
Yeah. Well, I'm just trying to live. You know, I've been doing classics for 22 years, right? So I'd come at it from the point of view as well of just like doing a lot of like wide classical study, all sorts of different things, kind of pivoting to all these different areas of the classical world. Then I just thought, what did that person think standing on the ground in, let's make up a date, I don't know, 100 BC.
400 BC.
Whatever you like. Make up. You want to go. Okay, you don't want that. Is it too late for you? I knew this was going to happen. There was going to be like a Roman Greek off at some point. But anyway, whatever date Liv wants, because it's Liv's podcast, we'll pick Liv's date. I mean, I'm just thinking, what are they? They're standing there. What are they thinking? Like, you know, what a weird thing to be living around anyway for anyone that lives in and around a volcano today. What an odd relationship you must have with your landscape. But what is that person thinking, standing there trying to figure out what is going on with this mountain and what's going to make it angry, what's going to subdue it or what have you? You know, I just find that really interesting. And that's kind of, I mean, obviously we can't know the answer to that. It's a completely ridiculous waste of time to try and do that. But by looking at all the different, you know, looking at all the different sources on all of this, you can maybe start piecing together a bit of a picture. And that's kind of why I love the volcanoes.
Yeah.
It's the constant threat, Liv. I mean, maybe it says something about who I am, but like if you're living under the shadow of that, that's like an impending, and it's that, again, it's that thing that gives you fertility in the soil, it gives you a chance to grow great crops and all these things that we know, but also it could destroy you any second, as we know happened in various parts of history. So does that make me a weirdo?
Not at all.
I'm listening back to it now thinking that makes me sound like a weirdo.
I mean, I grew up on the Ring of Fire. You know, I have lived on it most of my life, on and off. But to explain that to the listeners who don't know what that is, it's that really awesome ring that goes from all along the Pacific side of North America and some of South America, I imagine, loops right around to the across the Pacific, and just means that we have volcanoes and earthquakes. And one day, specifically where I live, one earthquake is going to hit and it's all going to be over. And we all just kind of live with that knowledge. And every once in a while, an article comes out that like talks about it. And then people from the East Coast come at us like, oh my God, did you hear about this? Are you scared? And I'm like, this has literally been a thing I've learned from a very young age. Just like,
but isn't, but okay, I mean, that's for us. I'm worried for you. And I'm worried for you because I'm from obviously the UK and I live in Devon in the UK now. What can get us here? I mean, I might slip on a cow pat and that might hurt me. But basically the threat of the natural landscape here is not as great.
No,
and then I'm fascinated by the threat of volcanoes, whereas you're like, meh, you know, whatever, or well, volcanoes or earthquakes. So I kind of, it's the unknown, isn't it? And that's what that's the thing about the monsters, right? Because so much of it is human psychology, fear of the unknown, fear of the other. So I'm perhaps more afraid of it than you might be, because it's something you've been, well, I'm not saying you're like, whoop-de-doo, there's an earthquake, but you're like, maybe you can, tension isn't as much for you than it is for me. I don't know, because I'm
fascinated by them, but yeah, I'm not afraid of them. But like, one of my favorite things, and we will get to monsters, but this is just fun now, but one of my favorite things is when somebody moves out here who's from like the East Coast. Like I had a friend who moved out here, and she's from Ontario, and we're just chatting, and she, at some point it came up, she's like, we had an earthquake last night, did you hear about that? Oh my god. And I was like, yeah dude, we have like 2 a week. She was like, oh my, like it absolutely blew her mind. But like, where we live on the Pacific Northwest specifically, but I don't at least, the very least around my island, there are like 1 to 2 earthquakes a week, and they're tiny, you don't feel them, but they happen all the time. And then you find out about that, and it's like suddenly, oh my god. Or another of my friends moved out here, and then there was an earthquake out across, or no, it was that volcanic eruption I think in Tonga, and that sent a tsunami warning. She was like, oh my god, there's a tsunami, are you close to the water, are you afraid? And it's like, again, those happen all the time. What I actually did was go down closer to the water so I could see the waves, and they were boring, and I was disappointed. And that's what happens when we get a tsunami warning when you're from here. And so anyway, these are the things I think you do adapt. But that's probably deeply relevant to the ancient world too. Like having now been to Santorini and to Akrotiri, which was like life achievement unlocked. One of the coolest things about Akrotiri, which is of course the Bronze Age town on Santorini that got preserved by the volcanic eruption of Thera, is that there were a ton of earthquakes there, and that like destroyed the city, and they just kept rebuilding it. And the final time, the big eruption, they were so prepared, and they had done it all so many times that not a single body has been found. So they just handled it, and they got off the island, and they probably all went to Crete and, you know, became refugees down there, which happened all around the Mediterranean at that time. But like, we're talking 16th or 1600s BCE, like going on 4,000 years ago. And these people were so prepared for an earthquake, so prepared for a volcanic eruption, that nobody died. And there haven't even been found animal remains. So they also got like their livestock off the island in time. And granted, like not all has been, you know, excavated and everything, but the amount of that town that they have, that not a single bit of human or animal remains has been found from that volcanic eruption, is incredible. So I think it does say to the psychology of people, like how much you do become used to it, and you become prepared, and you just like, you just handle your shit and you just do what needs to be done. And whether it's like there's a monster in your mountain or a volcano, like you just get it done.
Yeah, I love what you're saying. But I'm also just thinking about going, you know, now we're actually going to talk about classics for a moment. You know, the fact that these monsters have to symbolize a kind of perpetual threat, or they're kind of, that's one of the elements, right, of being a monster, you know, like. I know that someone spoke before about Cohen's monster thesis before on here, but you know, like one element of monster stories has to be that you can't vanquish it. You're not going to beat it forever. It's going to come back again. It's going to morph, because otherwise you conquer that fear or that anxiety forever and you lose it. So when you're talking about things like, well, obviously we need to talk about the ones that relate to monsters, because not every single story about volcanoes or earthquakes will relate directly to a monster, even though a lot of them do. It has to be perpetual, and that's where volcanoes I particularly found fascinating, because they're visible on the landscape, they're always there, and a lot of them are active. You know, I'm thinking particularly of the ones in southern Italy, and then, don't worry about it, I won't go too Roman on you before you freak out, but you know, like
Sicily was Greek, it's fine. Yeah,
but just because there's so many rich sources about the volcanoes of southern Italy, that, you know, that if we ever were able, if human beings were genuinely what you said and they became okay with it, then I don't think these monster stories would exist as they do today. So I'm not saying I disagree with you, but I think those are interesting different views, because you are right that I'm sure on one hand ancients are living around these volcanoes benefiting from them perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be okay with that, but at the same time there is the perpetual threat. So in that already is that, in the middle of all of that is the tension, and in fact is the monster in some ways, because that is the exact tension between the two things. And mm-hmm. it's that where the anxiety is, right? It's like, but I kind of need you, volcano, and you kind of provide crops and all sorts of things to me, but also you can kill me. And that in that middle ground is that tension. So, and to me that's where the monster is, sort mm-hmm. of in that little gap between the two things that you highlighted and what I highlighted. So,
well, but I also think there's a difference between being okay with something and being prepared for it. So I'm not saying that they wouldn't mm-hmm. have been terrified and anxious. Like I think both of our points are true, of just like there was all of that monstrous tension. Like there was the monster, but they also just had seen it happen before, and so they were just ready for it. It's almost like they were ready for Typhon to blow his lid, you know, and spew yeah, hot ash. Yeah. It doesn't make it
yeah.
not a monster anxiety or a monster idea, just more that they were like, okay, this has happened before. Like I think it more just speaks to their resilience in the face of that, you know, like they just became prepared. They were smart enough to see the pattern and still like have that anxiety to deal with. But they just yeah. were able to be like, okay, it's going to happen again. Like, let's get out kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying. So are you trying to say that in some ways they almost utilize that knowledge in a practical, pragmatic way to also ensure their own safety?
Yeah. Like, I don't think it means there wasn't a monstrous feeling the idea. Tension. Exactly. They yeah, just were able to also you. Be like, we have to get off the island, you know?
Yeah. I didn't mean to imply that they're like so silly that they're standing there going, ooh, you know, they're still people they want to survive, with survival instinct. Yeah. So, you know, a volcano goes off.
I mean, I don't know. Pompeii didn't do so well.
What's that movie, 2012, where what's the actor called? Where he stands there and he watches Yellowstone go up, you know?
Oh, yeah, John Cusack? Or no, it's the one.
No, Woody Harrelson what's he called?
That. Woody Harrelson, yeah.
Yes, that's right. Thank you.
I love that movie.
Because he's like, I want to see the show. And yeah. I always like to imagine that someone might have done that. I don't know, like at Vesuvius, I don't know. Probably not the nicest thing to say, but you know, well, you just think.
I mean, it feels like Pliny the Elder. You just to said me. That you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, maybe that's what he was all about.
I mean, because he was so interested in all of it. He just got too close.
I'm really annoyed that we've only just had this guy. So I was on Channel 4 talking about Pliny the Elder very recently. I really wish we'd had this chat before, because I'd have just added a little bit at the end, which was like, oh, yeah, here's all the archaeology, blah, blah, blah. But maybe he just fancied a little look at it and wanted to get closer, and it didn't work out well. Actually, it's decent though, isn't it? Because it's just you just said that, you know, you wanted to run down to the shore to look at the tsunami going on, and you were disappointed. There's something in that, but that is looking at the monstrous, isn't it? As well, like, you know, mm-hmm. you're gazing at it in some ways, because these spectacles are so, you know, there's that. It's that notion, you know, like when we look at psychology of pleasure and pain simultaneously being an element of the human psyche that we kind of need, and that's what is inherent in monster myth as well. So we want to look at the monstrous, and it's painful and difficult, but we derive some kind of pleasure from that process as well. I mean, obviously that's why we watch horror movies and whatever else you're into. So that's part of this as well, isn't it? You know, that's kind of why you ran down to the sea to look at the tsunami, because you're like, I want to see this thing, and it's terrifying, but also, you know, I'm kind of enjoying that at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's why we like disaster movies, right? Like, I love the movie 2012. Mm. Is it a great film? No. Is it an entertaining piece of, you know, or entertainment, you know, that has all of these like disaster elements? Like, yeah, I love volcano movies, all that. Would I want to be in a volcano? Oh my God, no. Those are horrifying. But I will watch the Tommy Lee Jones movie Volcano forever.
Yeah,
because
me too.
It's great.
I love, yeah. Dante's Peak, that's a winner.
Dante's Peak is great, but I really stand by Volcano. I think there's something about Tommy Lee Jones versus, what's his name? Why can't I think of him in Dante's Peak?
Oh, Pierce Brosnan.
Thank you. I was going to say James Bond, but that was also
007.
A yeah.
Never mind. If they don't know it, then they have to Google it. That's
yeah. I'm sorry, I'm an old millennial.
I'm trying really hard, but I haven't got any I'm trying, guys, but I've only just joined TikTok. I can't be trusted for these like really modern references. I'll do my best. I'm always ready to learn.
I'm trying to do TikTok right now, and I have never felt older in my whole life.
No way. I think I've got like, I mean, I doubled my followers in a day because I had like 4 and then I got like 8. So what I would suggest is starting low and then making big claims like that and then not hoping no one checks it. But yeah, we got off on a tangent. Monsters.
But I mean, volcanoes are interesting in themselves. This episode is all about that. They are. But so like, I'm curious how much of that feeds into Rome, because so much of, I mean, obviously what I know is Greek mythology. But so what's interesting to me is, like, I know the only surviving source we have for, say, the Gigantomachy, which I think is a really good volcanic specific story of monsters. But the only surviving source we have really is Pseudo-Apollodorus. So that's a person who's like Greek, but writing during the Roman period. And so and he really specifically sets the whole Gigantomachy in Sicily to explain the volcanic, you know, goings on down there. But did Rome have their own stories of monsters and everything for that region?
Yeah, I mean, they do. I mean, obviously, a lot of it is a continuation of what you see from the Greek tradition. But yeah, there are, I mean, Roman authors talk about the same things regularly. But I think the texts that interest me, there are plenty of, you know, Virgil will talk about it, you know, Ovid will. But I think that one of the areas that really interests me is a kind of the Roman, I guess I'm going to call it a trend, because that makes it sound too like it's purposeful or something. But the tendency perhaps of Romans to try and rationalize Greek mythology. And that's probably a bit of a new strand of interest in this. So less of the lyrical, poetic exploration of mythology that you're going to get from the Greek tradition, although that is absolutely happening through Roman poets like Ovid. But at the same time, I think that people like Strabo or Pliny the Elder that are like rationalizing things, I find them particularly interesting. So taking like the myth of Typhon, or, you know, one person I haven't talked about is the Chimera, who is like, you asked me at the very beginning who is my favorite monster.
Me too.
My favorite, because what the hell is going on with that?
Exactly.
With a goat on the back. Never will.
No.
I wrote my master's dissertation on the Chimera, and I still have not come across a reasonable explanation for why the chuffing owl, there's a goat on its back.
They breathe fire. It breathes it's fire. Wicked.
I know. But what I really like the idea of is someone just sitting there, just one day thinking, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to just create this thing and then sort of make it go ancient viral. And look now, we're looking at it now, trying to analyze it all seriously. But it's just someone sitting on a rock in Athens or wherever, just making this up. Anyway, so I went off point again. But, you know, so I think those are the texts that interest me the most, I think, because it's about how those texts, like Pliny the Elder, Strabo, how they try to, I guess, like, they're trying to own those myths in a different way by rationalizing them. And that, you know, there's a Roman tendency for that stuff anyway, right? You know, they kind of want to be logical and rational a little bit more, perhaps, than the Greeks do in terms of mythology. I mean, that's a horrible generalization. So, you know, let's not worry about that too much.
But no, it's
certainly in the volcanic stuff.
Yeah. I mean, if you have to label the two in that way, that it really does track, because so much is sort of basing itself on Greek myths, but you're right, like, is adding these rationalizing elements. But also, even just somebody like Ovid, you know, in Metamorphoses, for instance, is like writing explicitly, like, you know, 90% Greek myths, but he's writing them so intentionally that it completely like is a departure from the original or the traditional Greek sources, which were not being written to tell a story. They were being written to, like, you know, oral storytelling. I always go off on those tangents, but just basically, like, the differences between the oral tradition in Greece to, like, say, Ovid intentionally writing Metamorphoses is that sort of a bit of a rationalizing element as well, you know, just that kind of, the two ways in which they did it. Anyway, now I'm just rambling off, but
you're right. And I think that, you know, I think that's a really important, like you say, I guess I keep wanting to use, trend is not the right word. What do I want? I guess a trait, perhaps, is a better word, that of the Romans to want to do that a little bit more. I mean, why is a good question, maybe. I mean, it's not like the Greeks did not have logical thought or wanted to try and understand the world. I mean, what is philosophy if it isn't that? But I wonder why, you know, I guess, I know there's always this mad generalization, is it, about the Romans, they're the ones that build stuff and they're the engineers and they're all of that. And then the Greeks are the thinkers. But I wonder kind of why we see that trend towards this rationalization in general when it comes to volcanic giants. I was just thinking, you asked me like specifics as well. So Enceladus is like much more of a, almost like adopted a little bit more as the giant, the kind of creature that's underneath Etna.
Right.
And that's quite interesting because, you know, kind of like, not like a transference away from Typhon, because he's also mentioned in other texts, but we have that there. And I wonder, like, you know, sometimes I feel like the Romans might take something and try to create their own narrative to make it more specifically Roman. But I don't think, I mean, you might know a bit more about this than I do, but I'm not sure that Enceladus actually takes much of a role in Greek mythology. I don't know how often.
No.
Do you know how often, like, he pops up and stuff? Because but, you know, ultimately as well, would we say that he is monstrous? I mean, as far as I'm aware, is he not just, you know, kind of a giant?
Yeah.
Is he a monster then? Is a giant a monster? Because I guess for me, a monster is something. I always want to chuck a snake in there or something, but, you know, it feels like it's a composite of something else. I don't know. Like, is just a giant with no extra features a monster? I mean, that's a good question. I don't know. I've asked five questions. I'll be quiet now.
No, I love it. I was curious. And no, you're right. He doesn't appear before, like, Callimachus. So Callimachus is Hellenistic, but... he obviously would have had like a much closer relationship with the Romans just existing than anyone before. So yeah, there's no one earlier than Callimachus, which is fascinating because he's so late. But it's like,
yeah. So again, this is just more evidence for this guy sitting on the rock that's going, I'm gonna make something up.
Like, I'm gonna, like, I don't think it's Typhon under there. Like, I think it's a new guy. Let's invent a new.
I wonder what's the etymology. If you don't know, I don't know. How's your Greek? I mean, I don't have a lot of Greek, so my Greek's not great.
No, I don't have any Greek, but no, theoi.com is my life source, and it.
Oh,
means,
yeah, ditto. Don't worry.
Yeah, it says that the translation is "sound the charge." Which is interesting. To urge on. It's from the Greek.
I'm a bit of a fan of looking at the etymology. I like to make kind of utterly unsubstantiated claims. Don't worry. Anyone listening to me, I'm very clear when it's something that I can't really prove academically. So don't think, oh my God, has she just like lied to me?
I'm
forever.
Not. This show is my
thinking,
own theory.
What is that girl's podcast? I'm not going there. I'm going to learn nothing. But the one I've got, which is kind of my favorite thing at the moment, is, tell me what you think about this. I'm going to run it by you, Liv. Tell me if this sounds good. The Cyclops, another creature that we would associate with volcanoes for all sorts of reasons, but largely as, you know, kind of metal workers related to Hephaestus in the forge of the volcano. That's kind of their tradition. But Cyclops means kind of like, you know, orb-eyed, circle-eyed in the etymology. So to me, I decided that maybe this is, because that's a very odd feature of anything in myth to have like just one eye in the middle of the forehead. So I thought about this and I decided that perhaps it's something to do with the fact that when you look at a volcano, you have the shape of volcanoes is, you know, very circular crater kind of looking thing. And it could look like an eye on the landscape. I totally get that they're not flying around getting aerial views of this before anyone starts. Before the angry Twitter people come go, Jasmine, they're not flying around on like EasyJet looking over. I know that. But if you've ever stood, which I have, on a crater of a volcano, you can perceive that shape from the ground. So it's not completely insane. But, I mean, what do you reckon? I mean, it sounds nice, doesn't it? Which is usually a sign that it's not true. But
yeah, so I have some insights into this.
And I don't think it means, okay, because I've made that up. Maybe I'm not as well read as you. Go ahead.
No, so I don't I think maybe it's the opposite of what you're saying. So my fun fact is that in traditional Greek sources, so, you know, I would say like classical Greece and earlier, Hephaestus is not associated with volcanoes.
Okay.
He's just like a metal worker. So he doesn't actually have that connection.
Are the Cyclopes with him, though, at this
they
stage?
They are, and not in volcanoes.
So where are they then?
They just have a forge. So it's probably like in the earth. It might have some kind of like more cave-like ideas. And maybe there's even some like other associations, and maybe it's also, you know, missing sources or whatever, but in terms of ancient Greek classical and archaic and beyond sources, they don't have the volcanic associations. He's not a god of volcanoes until later, and I think that that's because he's Vulcan, and so I actually think that the association with the volcanoes came from Rome, in a way that more often than not, you know, Rome gets their associations from Greek, but in this case it's the opposite.
That's interesting.
I love it, because I like the volcano stuff I love. So the Hephaestus connection was a thing that I forget when I learned this, but it's really interesting.
No, that sounds really cool. I'd love to kind of interrogate the sources a bit more as well, to look at when they talk about the, I mean, this is getting very nitty gritty now. So when these sources that you just mentioned speak about the forge, what is the vocabulary around that? And how explicitly is it not volcanic as well? You know, because I know I'd be like, what is a forge? I mean, you think about a forge, it's a hot place. There's molten metal and things, whatever. So while they might not explicitly name it, so I've got a few points. They might not explicitly name it, but insinuate it. I mean, we'd have to detailed literary analysis to know if that's true. By the way, if anyone knows this and they're listening going, I know the answer, then tell us.
Yeah.
But, you know, this would be the method to investigate this, right? You go and do that, look at the kind of analysis of it. Two, the dating of the text that you mentioned will be really interesting as well, because I know you've mentioned a broad period there, but could it be also that we are dealing with, like, you know, post Santorini eruption, I imagine, and then pre kind of big Etna eruptions and stuff, so we're in a bit of a time period where people perhaps don't have as much personal experience of the volcanoes, maybe it's so then, you know. And also the third point, I guess, I mean, that's just an interesting point rather than any particular evaluation. But I guess the third point as well is the thing that I know you love about myth, I do too, is kind of, you know, new ownership of myth and adaptation of myth throughout the classical period. So none being an invalid viewpoint, really, because even if there is a canon of like, this is what normally happens, this is the actual generic story of this person. We know that. The great thing about myth is you play with it, you mold it. It's like a piece of clay. You can make it what you like. That's what made it cool and fun. And that's what also, as, you know, I guess, classicists, ageist historians, whatever you want to call yourself, you kind of are able then to glean information from that, because you're looking at cultural responses, right? So that's enough points, but you get my idea.
Yeah. No, I think it is all of that. So ultimately, I think a huge key part to this too is that Greece – broadly is not very volcanic. Italy, southern Italy, is super volcanic, and the little portion of the Cyclades that are volcanic are volcanic. But in terms of volcanic eruptions that I know of, and this isn't something I've done a whole ton of research about, but Thera erupted, in late Bronze Age, right? So
yeah, it's like, I think it's about 1600, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. Yeah. It's 17th century sometime. So Thera erupted sometime around then. And then we have the, you know, quote unquote Bronze Age decline, that being not a decline, but a change. But essentially, there's like an enormous gap of time, right, before the written works that survive to us today are actually being put to paper, quote unquote. And so between that and the just general lack of volcanic activity in Greece, like, I think that we're talking about the time period, and this is, again, generalization. I don't know when Sicily became heavily Greek, but I do think it's like not early Iron Age, early Archaic, or like late early Iron Age, early Archaic, you know? So it's not the time when, say, Hesiod's work are coming around, and Homer and all of that. And so we don't get these early associations with volcanoes because I don't think they had a lot of volcanic goings on. And so they didn't have like a reference point for, say, Hephaestus and the Cyclops being in a volcano because they didn't have volcanoes. Like mainland Greece is not very volcanic at all, right? And so unless you're having these like really close associations with Thera, or you're seeing it, but like, I don't, yeah, because Thera is also pretty far off too. So it's just like, it's sort of fascinating to see it that way. And then you can see when Sicily becomes heavily Greek, then you're getting these new associations with volcanoes because they're seeing volcanoes. And so that's might be around the time when this kind of conflation, like I actually think Vulcan and Hephaestus weren't always the same, quote unquote, I'm doing a lot of that, the same god, you know, like I think that they probably had a volcanic god. And then he ends up being associated with Hephaestus more closely. Like the volcano stuff to me seems to come from not necessarily Rome explicitly, but from that like growth of the Greek world into Italy. And then maybe the close relationship they developed with Rome.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, there's obvious points to that because, you know, we've said already that the Romans are going to be more invested, I guess, in volcanoes because they live amongst them a little bit more. But then actually what's interesting, so the Chimera, for example, mm-hmm. we have rationalization about that. Again, we're not talking about that being in the Greek period, that's in the Roman period. But that's really interesting because there's some marks on the landscape that really sound like they've interpreted those. So it's like Pliny the Elder and Strabo that mention this, and they mention an area in Lycia, so you know, in Turkey, that is called Mount Chimera or something like around that. And you know, Pliny tells us that it sends forth flames at night and things like that. So, but there as well is, you know, it's near the city state of Hephaestium. So there's a connection even there to it. And the mountain range being on fire and stuff like that. But you know, like this is obviously much later again. So making the point that I'm making the same point really, I think. But also it's interesting that they're seeing things on the landscape because this region now, the Iñárritu region in Turkey. Now, I'm sorry if I've mispronounced Turkish there to anyone that speaks Turkish, but it's this region that is like, it's like burnt and charred and it has these methane like flames that come up and it's kind of crazy. If you Google it, it's really crazy. And that's the landscape they're trying to describe. And that's where the Chimera was supposed to have been like, you know, kind of besieging things and marauding and doing the weird fire thing out of the goat's mouth. So you get that as well in Turkey. So I think that there is an association. It's not just Greece and Rome, but although, you know, I mean, obviously we can't even get into wider mythologies where there is so much about this in all sorts of different ancient cultures. But you're getting that a little bit in that region too. So
no, I don't know, it's just so interesting.
And Strabo says it's just, he doesn't actually say it's fiery, but I'll just take it anyway. But I'll claim that for the team. I think he says that the Mount Chimera is just like a ravine, but it is alluding to the mountainous nature of it. But again, I can go off one of my crazy theories about why that might be the case. But I think we'll stop there with that.
Well, now I'm fascinated. I love the Chimera so much. So now I'm just looking into that area. Like I know that the whole story of the Chimera comes from the East, which I think has always been super cool. I think the Chimera too, though, like even based on this, it seems like they're less associating it with a volcano and more like the volcanic happenings within the earth, but something that they're seeing and doesn't look like the same volcanoes they're used to. So they're more associating it with like a chimera's breath in an interesting way, or at least in the more ancient sourcing. Because I'm curious like when there's a temple of Hephaestus, and I'm curious when it was built, but I can't find that. But also when you first said it, I was wondering, but it seems like there is that Hephaestus specific reference. But I wonder if it's coming from like the Hellenistic period.
Yeah, and you made that point that this is probably a later addition or certainly kind of, you know, collab, shall we call it.
Yeah.
Between these things. And I think, you know, that's an interesting take on it. So
I'm just so curious now too.
Looking for a fabulous fashion brand that celebrates you? Then look no further than Boston Proper, where styles are designed with you in mind, so you can look and feel amazing, no matter the day, season, or occasion. At bostonproper.com, you'll find fashion that knows you best. For over 30 years, Boston Proper has been the fashion destination for confident women who want to elevate their look with unique, sophisticated clothing at affordable prices. Visit bostonproper.com today. Boston Proper. Wear it like no one else.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbionica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or toxins. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbionica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbionica.com. Symbiotica.com.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
But anyway, the monsters are just cool. I mean, they're just cool. I mean, I've always loved them. And it's not just volcanoes that make them cool. It's other stuff. So I'm big into... I mean, let's just get this spoiler alert straight away out there. I'm going to be talking about human psychology and psychologists specifically and their take on it. And okay. I'm doing it. I fully accept that very little of it is useful to us today, but I find it hilarious. I find it hilarious to look at what Freud says about monsters.
Oh, God. Okay. Yep.
You get me? Because it's so fun. Just anyone listening... Do not take any of this as real, essentially.
No.
But have you ever read his essay, Medusa's Head?
Oh, God, no, but I've heard of it.
Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, it's
all about, like, he's got all that nonsensical ideas of her snake hair being, like, fear of castration or something like that, right?
Yeah,
like,
you got it. Yes, it's like, so, I mean, he wrote it in 1922. I think it's actually published after he died, but whatever. And it's just complete. I just don't know what he's thinking. He's definitely man sitting on a rock making stuff up for sure. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it's all about what is the symbolism of Medusa, the snakes, and you know, apparently it's a young boy that sees his mother's pubic hair. It's the snakes. It's the snakes, and all sorts of different symbolism of that. But essentially, it's this kind of like. Shock horror feeling that oh my god, what if I didn't have a penis? And it got, and then obviously the beheading of Medusa is the castration, and you know, you just can't follow it. It's completely insane. It's like this, I get like kind of odd dream that you think what's going on, nightmare of what's going on. So yes, now I'm not saying we can take anything from that. But I kind of find it in terms of like classical reception, maybe like looking at what's going on with these psychologists. And I think, you know, okay, that's the maddest example I've got, but actually that, you know, there are a few things you can take from psychologists. And I think, you know, the biggest caveat with any of this is that they are often scientists. They might be anthropologists or psychologists, and they love like essentially a kind of unifying theory. Mm-hmm. So whereas we're like, you know, you've spent a whole career deep diving into the nuances of myth, and you're going to continue doing that. You could go till you die, because there's so much nuance, and you can't just go, oh well, all Romans were this, bye, because what's the point of that, you know? So that's what I find really interesting about this, you know, that's what the caveat is with these psychologists, because they want to do that. They want these theories that go, oh, all cultures do this and all monsters mean this in mythology. But then there's some interesting stuff about, and actually Aristotle says it, about how monstrous myths need to happen because we need a way of purging our fears to avoid us having antisocial tendencies. And I thought you would love this because it's going back to very early societies and the need for human beings to conform and come together in a way of behaving, you know, kind of, I guess, a manner of how we behave as a civilization, as a group of people, mm-hmm. as an organization almost of people. So we need these monsters as a way to purge the fears in our stories, in whatever we want to do, so that we don't take them out on each other. And I don't know what you think to that. And there's a few, you know, Aristotle says it, but there, you know, there's a few, I guess, little bits and pieces throughout time, different psychologists, either modern or ancient, the kind of not ancient psychologists, but ancient thinkers that mm-hmm. say that sort of thing. But I don't know what your take on that is. What do you think about that as sort of tension of early society?
Yeah, it makes sense. It certainly makes more sense than Freud's nonsensical musings about Greek myth.
But it's fun.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, all I could think of when you were first saying that is the Oedipus of it all.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, I'll never get over the fact that, like, the entire modern understanding of, like, the Oedipus myth and Oedipal complex or whatever based around Freud is, like, based on a willful misunderstanding of that play. It's like he had to read the play and be like, okay, cool. I'm going to completely invent a new plot point, and I'm going to base an entire theory on that plot point, which is that somehow Oedipus knew that it was his mother.
What I don't get, Liv, is like, how did he get any airtime, Freud? Why didn't someone go, all right, off you go? Yeah. I heard what he had to say. No, thanks. Like, what is it about this it's the time when these, you know, these kind of old white men get this
job. Yeah.
You can all say what you want, talk. And we're going to say it's fine. Like,
yep.
I don't get it. I don't get it because we all know, like, you know, evidence-based things. And I guess it's highly, I'm not a psychologist. I understand it's theoretical and these are takes on perhaps expressions of human behavior. But come on. Mm-hmm. I just don't get how that guy got any airtime.
No.
So I get you. Yeah, the Oedipus thing's mad as well. Completely mad.
Oh, and then there's like there's an Electra complex too, right? I forget what that one
is.
Like murdering your mother or something. Lord. I mean, anyway, I think he just had a lot of issues with his parents and he took them all out on us for the next 100 years.
And he decided to use classics as much as possible.
Exactly. He just decided to be like, 100 years from now, people are going to be really mad at me for the bullshit that I'm spewing. Ha ha. Enjoy.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? Do you like looking at things like that, that are obviously a load of rubbish, but looking at what they really kind of tell us about, I guess, the continuing relationship? Well, if we're going back to monsters for a minute, like, you know, kind of how interaction with monsters are evolving over time. So here we have that trend in the 20th century of looking at monsters of mythology, world mythology, not just classical, mm-hmm. and like trying to reevaluate them for a new take on it. And what they express about who we are and the monster in us.
I mean, well, yeah, I
just
mean,
even if the stuff is mad, even if the conclusions are mad, that on its own as a movement is interesting to look at and how it's impacted us today.
Yeah, it just makes me think of Medusa today, right? And like all the different forms that she takes in our society today. Like there is such a juxtaposition of like angry dudes on the internet who see Medusa as some kind of like evil like force that had to be destroyed in order to, you know, alleviate some kind of pressure on the world, which is basically a paraphrase of some nonsense thing that a guy once spewed to me on Twitter. And then we have her they're ridiculous, and then that's compared to angry white men.
It's all right, they're not listening to this. They're not coming from us.
No, it's all good. No. But compared to the Medusa of like the feminist movement or the Me Too movement, and now Medusa has now come to symbolize a survivor of assault to such a degree that like, so I have a Medusa tattoo because I love Medusa and I love classics, and obviously
can I see
like,
it, or is it somewhere where I'm not allowed to
no,
see it?
No, it's on my thigh. but it's in, yeah, we're not doing that today, but no, it's enormous.
It's not that kind of podcast.
But I posted pictures of it fairly recently, on Instagram, and I posted two different pictures, and two different times somebody commented and made an assumption that because I have a Medusa tattoo, I am telling the world that I'm a survivor of assault. And like, I'm not saying that I haven't had my own experiences. As women, we basically all have our own, you know, varied experiences mm-hmm. in different ways. But, mm-hmm. but like, that's not why I got a Medusa tattoo. I got a Medusa tattoo because I fucking love Medusa. But she has become this emblem to such a degree that like, and even somebody actually recently messaged me and said like, hey, it was a guy. And he was like, hey, I want to get a Medusa tattoo, but my friend said that would be disrespectful because it symbolizes survival of assault. And that's just, to me, it's like, I think that's great that she symbolizes that for people. I think it's bad if we are making assumptions that like, that is now all she symbolizes.
Yeah, I mean, I agree.
Yeah, yeah, she's come like full circle and to be like, that's it.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting this actually, because I'm working on something at the moment that is about essentially the unheard voices of women that have experienced any kind of
sexual abuse. I saw your post on
sexual
Twitter.
Abuse. Yeah, so this is something I'm working on. It's something I'm new to it. So I'm not new to it in life, as in I know of this in my life, but I'm not somebody that I can say has experienced it directly in the same way that you mentioned earlier on. But you know, I think that we owe it to these mythical figures to get to the nuance of them. So if that means something to someone, then great. You own it as you wish. Take that symbol, use it as you wish. But I think it's important that we have that like plurality of her story too. So, you know, if a guy wants to get Medusa tattooed on him and his intentions are not ill, you know, that he's doing that for reasons if the reasons are good, like I love her, I find the story interesting, whatever it might be, fine. And I do think, you know, that in some way, this is a difficult thing to say because, you know, I'm pro anything that makes anyone feel better, empowered, especially women. That's what I'm all about. But at the same time, you don't want to take it so far that it almost becomes a weaponized type thing. Weaponized is a very strong word to use, but I guess something like that. And also like the whole reading into you getting that, like that's just no one's business anyway. Like that's up to you. Like you can do what you want. That's your body. If you want to get Medusa, and don't infer, it's no one's business what meaning that has. That's your personal choice to do that. That's your business. Like, no one should be commenting. I mean, unless they're commenting like, oh, that's wicked. I guess, you know, there's nothing you should. I mean, wicked in, we say wicked a lot. That means really good. No, right? Yeah. Does that mean? Okay, good. No, like wicked witch. I'm like, oh my God, have I just said something awful in Canada? And all the Canadians are going to cancel me.
That is in North America too. You're good.
Yeah. Sweet. I mean, it's fascinating what you say. I mean, this is what this is another reason, going back to like full circle almost, on why I like monsters, because I do think, although we can draw out these like general ideas, like we talked about volcanoes, or we can talk about elements of the human psyche that we see in these stories, but really what you personally find monstrous is different to everyone else, and what I personally find monstrous is different to everyone else, and there might be some overlap. We did a Venn diagram or whatever it's called. What is that, the one where they overlap? I think that's the one, isn't it?
Yeah,
we all find some overlap, and I think, you know, that's where we, as I guess ancient historians or whatever you like to call yourself, it's in the overlap that we analyze. I think, but just being a person, monsters mean something to me. Like, I've got a thing. The thing that I'm terrified of is aliens. So, like, but then a friend of mine's like, I can't watch a ghost film. Like, she'll just run and she can't cope. She like starts shaking because that's her thing. You know, I still don't understand the people that like Squid Game, like Blood and Gore. I can't get to that. Are you one of them?
Yeah. No.
I mean, but do you get my? But that's. Yeah. I mean, I don't know why. I'm questioning why they're watching in the first place. But if they're watching it for the horror bit, that we, you know, like they like to be afraid of it. I don't know. I find that gore, that Saw, all that kind of horror.
Yeah.
I find that difficult. But you know, that's why I like monsters. They're adaptable, and I think, you know, they shapeshift and they do different things in different times to different people in different contexts, and that's why they'll always be our monsters, even if they might be ancient, because they're just going to be ours. Because like you say, Medusa is on your thigh right now, and that is some way that, like, not literally if anyone's freaking out, but but you've got that for your reasons, And that speaks to you in some way. So, you know, you've already taken something mythological, monstrous myth and made it your own, which I think is how we should be doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, she's my monster in that respect. But if we're, you know, like monsters generally, I've always loved them. Chimera is, I think, probably my favorite in terms of the just like the randomness. More traditional monsters. I do love the Hecatonchires because...
Yes. Is it because you can say it?
Them. Yes, I love the word.
How many
but
years
also...
did it take you to be able to say it? Because I'm still working on it.
Oh, no, that one came naturally. No, it's one of the words I explicitly remember from my undergrad mythology courses in a way that, like, I don't remember many. Like, I think I remember Hecatonchires. I remember that my prof pronounced it Uranus to make it not sound like the planet Uranus in North America. We like to say that Uranus works too. Anything, you know, make it sound more serious, all these different things. But yeah, no, Hecatonchires are, I just like imagining them. I like to think, okay, you're really, really thought up a creature that is sometimes volcanic as well. That really just had 100 hands and 50 heads. That makes sense, right? Yeah. And it just like, really? Okay. Somebody just thought that up and just said, yeah, there are three of them.
Well, we're back to the guy on the rock, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, I think I can never, anytime anyone asks me my favorite, the only other favorite I've got is the Minotaur.
Mm.
So like, I mean, I just love obviously the Chimera, but I do also really love the Minotaur. And in fact, I'm working on a novel now about the Minotaur.
Mm.
But what's interesting about the Minotaur is we don't have that much stuff written about him.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much about your favourite guy, Theseus.
Your bestie. My love.
I know how much you're into him, so before you pretend, come on now. I think you protest so much, it's actually got a massive crush on him. That's what I think what's going on.
I think it's my love of Athens coming through. That's what I'll admit to that.
Yeah, but, you know, there's so, obviously, I get why, you know, I get why we hear so much about Theseus and not the Minotaur. And he always just seems like this, it saddens me, his story, because he always just seems like this kind of footnote in stories, and he never really gets his own agency, which is what I'm trying to change. But he fascinates me. I mean, there is a little bit here about him maybe being the description of earthquakes and his bellowings in the labyrinth. You know, I like that. I do like that. But, you know, I think that that's not necessarily prolific, the number of people that might describe him in that way. But I find it interesting because I think he's quite Frankenstein-esque, if I'm going to put it that way. Like, he's one of the few monsters that we, and there are obviously other examples, of course, but I'm just saying one of, I guess, a select number of monsters that have human ancestry as well as beast-like ancestry. And I just find that really interesting.
What I find so fascinating about him and his human ancestry is that while he's one of a few that has it, as far as I know, he is the singular ancient monster that, like, one is singular in that way with human attributes, but also specifically is top half animal, bottom half human.
And I think
that makes him really special because he has all the monstrous qualities of his top half, but also that human bit. So he's so different from, like, a centaur or something, you know, in that way, and was created so specifically.
For sure. And someone asked me, in fact, it was my husband. He asked me the other day, he said, are centaurs monsters? If not, why not? And I was just like, that's a great question, because they are animal, human hybrids. You know, they're a bit naughty, you can say. And I was like, well, what elements do they not have? You know, I guess it's this kind of perpetual threat that we kind of connect to the monster.
They were pretty threatening, though, because other than Chiron...
They were.
Yeah, they were violent. They came through. They almost kind of represent, like, marauders in a way, you know? Like, tearing through a town.
But we don't consider them monsters. We don't put them with monsters, do we? As the within the genre... Well, you're right. This is why I think it's really interesting, because why do we not? I mean, again, someone there will be some academic work out there, some secondary school source work that's on this that I just don't know. But because, you know, their character, they do display, as you say, the marauding nature, the threat, the kind of oddity about their appearance, animal-human hybrid like vibes that are going on. But they're not, are they? And actually, like you say, you have the connection with Corin and wisdom sometimes, you know. So it's a bit of a weird one, isn't it?
The interesting thing about the one bit of the knowledge aspect, the Chiron of it all, is that he, while he is a centaur, is typically depicted as a, like, it's almost as if he's a different type of centaur. Like, he has a different birth story than the others. He's not born of the same way. And in art, he's often depicted, have you seen these, where he's not a traditional centaur? He is like full man with a horse's backside coming off of his back.
Do you know what? I'm not going to lie. I'm not an expert on the centaurs. It's not something I've looked at, but that is definitely getting Googled in a minute.
Yeah, because so it's crazy. Great. It's only Chiron. And so they really often in both art and text sources make a real point of separating him from the others. The others are monstrous. The others attack. The others war with Heracles, like all those different things. The others are bad and Chiron is good. And so they give him, a different birth story, a different like storyline broadly, and specifically in art, often, not always, but often, he's full man, to the point where the first thing you are going to wonder if you are a real human when you look at this art is, does that mean he has two penises? And I think the answer is yes. Yeah.
Let's just say it's yes anyway. It's a bit like when I was making up stuff about the Cyclops and his eye. Like, let's just, sometimes it's fun just to make whatever kind of conclusion you fancy. And as long as you're explicit about that, that's fine.
And I think your Cyclops thing still almost works. Like, I think what it is more so, I think it came later, but I think they probably still were like seeing craters and then maybe connecting with the Cyclops in that way. You know, like it can still work even if it didn't start it, but rather came after the fact. Like all of these things are still working like in such close relation to each other, because everything is developing over so many hundreds and then thousands of years of like this evolution, but also just, you know, just the growing nature of these people and the way they changed over all that time. Like, it's just
for sure. But that's what makes it so cool. Yeah, exactly. It makes it so cool because it's like you'll never pin it, like the monster, you'll never really pin it down. We're never gonna just get to the end of that is the definite answer forever and ever and ever about this particular topic theme, whatever my monster, whatever you want. It's always gonna be like, oh, another idea. And I guess all subjects are like, let's be real, you know, even scientists, it's like, this is the point that we're at now. And then we evolve, we research, we do things, and we go further. So, you know, but, you know, I do love that about monsters. And what I really enjoy is, you know, as we progress as people, even today, things that we're interested in today, you get these new revisions and kind of, you know, interpretations of things. Obviously, I know you've spoken to a number of excellent authors that are working in the field where they're, you know, they're doing their own storytelling. They're taking this mythological canon and they're turning it into their own thing. But I love that. It's so poetic, because that's what the Greeks did and that's what people are doing again. And I love that. I love that because your work as well, anytime you're taking mythical inspiration and making it your own, you are doing what the Greeks intended, because that's what people did. That's what it was about. And I think if anyone ever, you know, sometimes these things come under fire, don't they? Because, you haven't really represented it properly. And, there's all this nuance that you haven't included. And I'm like, no, stuff that, because this is actually what the Greeks want you to do. So I'm just going to do what they want. You know, you're not saying, here's everything ever written on a topic, you know, like, you know, it's not 100% factually. There's a bit of artistic license. But I love that. I love that. And I think that's how we should be doing myth in general.
Yeah. Just, you know, taking it and your making it our own. Yeah. Well, and my favorite thing to do these days, and thankfully my listeners seem to like it also, is like to also often revisit myths that I covered 5 years ago on the show, because just like mythology, like I have changed a lot in 5 years, and my ability to research and provide that nuance and all these different things like has grown so much. And so like they really are completely timeless, you know, like you're always going to discover something new. You're always going to find some new contextual, like historical thing that adds layers to it. Like the more I understand the ancient world, the more I understand the mythology in a way that makes me so fucking happy, just like all the time, because every time I learn something new, it you know, something opens up in my mind. I just recently spoke to Stephanie McCarter on the show, who's just translated Ovid, Metamorphoses. Cool. So she's like the first woman to translate it in 60 years. And she went into it with like feminist ideals and looking at, you know, what other translators have and have not done. And it's just so exciting, you know, and even just talking to somebody about that process of translation opens up so many new avenues of thought and so many new ways to understand a source. And it's just like, just, it's endless.
Well, I mean, even in my work in the media, you know, like this is my voice that people hopefully are still listening to. I haven't like turned off by now, but this is my voice, my take. It's from my personal background. You know, I grew up in a very poor part of London. We didn't have anything, single parent. I'm mixed race. I say those things not for any particular reason, except for those are the things that feed into who I am, partly. And all I ever do with classics, this is my voice, my take. This is my view of something. This is why I have this view, because I'm bringing my experience right to it. And my aim, and I know it's the same as yours, is in our subject, just getting plurality of voices, getting as many people from different backgrounds speaking about it, so that we represent the classical world in a way that others can understand it. That's what we're all about, right? Is this mm-hmm. I'm speaking to people. Some people listening to this are gonna be thinking, not my cup of tea, and other people are gonna be thinking, this really speaks to me. The way that this person is speaking about classics is making me feel like I want to do more. And that's what we're trying to do, I think. And also in academic and scholarly work, when these people are bringing their take on it, is so valuable, because no one is saying, here is the final answer. As we said at the beginning of this chat, you know, this isn't the final take on this, but this is something that I'm bringing to the table now in this present moment with my experience, with my whatever it might be. And hopefully it contributes to a wider range of voices in this subject. So anyone that's doing that and beating their own drum, I mean, that's just awesome. And I hope that people are enjoying it. And they obviously are, Liv, because you're doing a great job with the podcast. So there you go.
Well, thank you. I think my show and yours and all of that really proves how much people do want to learn about this stuff. And one thing I've learned over these years is like, they don't just want to hear the stories, you know, they are interested in learning the more nitty gritty side, the really nerdy stuff that's underneath that you don't really learn as just like a regular person interested in this topic. And that's why like talking to people like you and like all the other academics that I've had on my show is always so exciting, because it brings this whole new realm of myth and the ancient Mediterranean to people who aren't studying it, and so therefore like really have no access point. I mean, I barely have an access point into the academic side, and I've been doing this for 5 years and I'm like a name in it, and I'm still like, I don't know where to begin learning about the more academic aspects, the more like, you know, little pieces that don't make it out into the wider world because they're only published in books that are like $100 and intended for university libraries only.
Yeah,
and like,
no, that's exactly right. Yeah.
So getting that stuff out there is just, it's so important, but also like so valuable, and people legitimately want to learn it. And I think that is the coolest thing.
Yeah, so we should just thank everyone that listens to you or me.
I mean, absolutely.
And continues to support it, right? Because thank God for them. Absolutely. We need you. You're such a big part of this.
And also keep me with a career thing.
That's why, like with my podcast, the whole I guess content of it, not content, what's the word I want? The whole format, that's the word. Mm. Oh my God, what a long day. The whole format of my podcast, it is, I just think, from somebody that came at it as an adult, I started classics at 18. So I was like, I don't know what this is. And I was like, a random choice, go do that. Loved it, stayed there. The thing that I have, and in my 22 years in the subject in all sorts of different ways, what I've understood is that we need to go to the people, not trying to always get the people to come to us. So mm-hmm. there's a tendency, certainly here in the UK, where it's like, you know, I'm going to do a thing about Roman soldiers And then people will just come to that. And it's like, well, of course, some people do. You know, you get people that are like, yeah, great, great. That's fun. That's great. But I'm kind of up for the people that are like, you tell me why I should come. Mm-hmm. And that's why in my podcast, the format is a non-specialist. They're a UK celebrity. And they come on and they know something about a topic like wine. And then I talk about ancient wine and they talk about wine. And we look over topics that we're interested in today, like people being teetotal. 25% of Brits are teetotal today. And there are loads of reasons why. But teetotal, don't drink.
Oh, okay.
What do you call that in Canada?
Don't drink.
Okay. It's all good. Whatever floats
your boat.
I've
heard that term before, but never as like thing that people can be.
Good to know. No, it's good to know. So teetotalers are people that do not drink alcohol. No. So it was like 25% of young, you know, British people don't drink. And it's like, well, that's I guess a bit of a trend. And some of those reasons are health related, of course. But also it's like, then we looked at like what ancient Greek and Roman authors said about teetotalers. And I trust me, you can imagine. It wasn't that great.
But also, like, what do you drink if you can't drink, if you don't drink wine in the ancient world? Like, literally.
Nothing.
What do
can't
you
drink?
Can't
drink milk. Can't drink
milk. You can't
milk.
Drink, like, water,
there's no
really,
oat
though.
Milk either. Can't do lactose intolerance or anything back then. Neither could you. What did you drink? Well, water's probably going to kill you off, isn't it?
Unless yeah, exactly. So, like, you're not even drinking water. What are you doing?
You have to just get on with it. You haven't got a choice. You have to get on with it. You can't just go, right, I'm going to go get a Diet Coke. This sucks. You've got to get on with it, haven't you?
That's wild.
Good question. Maybe someone. I mean, the wine stuff was really interesting because actually, I don't know. Do you drink wine, Liv? Are you a wine drinker?
Oh my, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Wicked. So, I used to live in New Zealand. So when I lived there, I got particularly into wine because it's like, you know, New Zealand. That's, if you're from New Zealand, oh my god. Well,
New Zealand white wine. Well, one type is my favorite thing in the whole world.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm a white wine. I'm not a red wine drinker. It's not my style. No. So I'm always like white and fizzy and pink. So this was really interesting because I'm thinking like, what is it in the core, like the taste of wines that I'm interested in? Like, what do I like? Yeah. And what was it like for them? And I know you don't talk as much about Roman stuff, but they had this wine called Malsum, which is like this sort of like Swedish sort of weirdness, like vinegary sweet. I don't really know. I can't really understand what it tastes like.
Vinegary sweet. Oof.
Yeah, I think they sweetened it. The cheaper you went, the sweeter it got, because I had to try and make it taste. I think the base of it is. Yeah. Yes, exactly. did you have Lambrini? Did you know what that is?
No.
Lambrini. This might be a very British thing. It also might be a very I'm nearly 40 thing. But there was this fizzy drink called Lambrini that's like a, I don't know what the alcohol content is, but it's like this super sweet white wine. And I think it was literally like the lowest alcohol ever. But when you were like 15, you were like, mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, we have those.
I'm not saying that I was drinking at 15 in case someone tells the police on me, but I just mean like generically.
You're British, isn't that fine?
Probably. Don't know. Don't want to knock at the door. Anyway, so it looks like that, the wine, like kind of like does the taste of wine. And I love doing that because I'm learning at the same time. I got a little wine lesson out of that one. I was like, ooh, that's really interesting. And we were talking about the trend for organic wines and basically how every wine would have been organic in the Roman, Greek and Roman period. And people wanting to go back to that and how that affects taste and production. And I learned so much. So kind of love all that kind of way of learning, really, because I'm learning at the same time. Because I really am, because I'm talking to someone. I've just recorded one actually on thrillers, and there's a little bit of monsters in there, which I tried not to talk about for 500 hours on, which is not easy. But yeah, so, but that's one minute I'm doing monsters, something that I, you know, this is one of my things, this is one of my specialisms, I really enjoy it. But then the next minute I'm talking about wine, and Liv, I don't know anything about ancient wine. I had to research all of that, talk to the academics in the field, revise that, and find these little, I guess, talking points that I thought would be really interesting. So, I mean, it's a good learning curve. I enjoy it. I enjoy doing it. It's good fun.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I love about my conversations generally, is how much I learn. Obviously, it's usually like really specific topics in my field. But even at the same time, like, I mean, one, obviously, academics teach me a million things when I talk to them. But also there's something about having a conversation like this where you get out new theories and things, you know, just by saying them out loud to another person and like sharing your different thoughts on it is so fascinating because you really do get so much more out of it than you do just like thinking about it on your own, you know? Like, yeah, it's such a perfect way to learn.
Maybe you should rename the podcast like Liv's Ancient Therapy Sessions or something, where people can come and offload about whatever particular theory they're struggling with or what have you. Because it sometimes feels like that.
Oh, yeah. And like, and at this point, you know, my guests rarely come on to talk about myths. So it's like, oh, God, I need a new podcast name. Generally, this show has grown so much. Like, I still do myths on the scripted episodes. But otherwise, I'm just like, do you have something about the ancient Mediterranean that you want to tell me about? Great. Come on the show. I am not picky.
Sounds good. Yeah, you think we need that. Let's talk about stuff, baby.
Let's talk about the ancient Mediterranean history, mythology, everything.
Can you imagine how long when people are typing in or typing in? They're not like, you know, it's not a typewriter, but, you know, looking for it. Like, I can't be bothered. This is far too much. You need something short and snappy, like legit classics. Have you got any Latin? Do you know any Latin, or is it Greek?
Minimal. And I don't have either language.
So legit is like it's a play on words because it's from Lego to choose. So literally she chooses classics. But also, I don't know if you know the word legit is a very like, I guess. London, like, you know, I know the word means that we all know what the word legit means, legitimate. Yeah. But it's a very like London, like, oh, it's legit. It's like very a London way of talking as well. So
we do that.
I had some clangers written down before that. I mean, I'll have to dig them out to tell you, but they were not good, some of them. I think it was Rome wasn't built in a day, I thought, because that could be interesting. But there were some really good ones. I'll have to look at my notes to find out what something, but yeah, it was legit classics in the end because I quite liked it.
I had a grand total of one podcast title idea, and it is this. It is the end result. I put in absolutely no thought and absolutely did not consider what it would be like to tell people that my podcast was named this for the next 5 years.
You weren't expecting such success. So, but then I know you sometimes like to sing it, don't you? You sometimes like to.
I only sing it in the intro. Tune. Yeah, when I'm alone.
So you're not going to do it now for me then?
Absolutely not. No.
Thank you so much for having me on. And I mean it like, you know, from someone starting out, like, I'm so impressed by your, without sounding like patronizing, I didn't mean that in any way, but like your commitment and the day, like I said, the days where you have to keep going and the fact that you've built this on your own, it's just phenomenal.
Thank you so much for coming on because it's been so much fun and it's so exciting. And thank you for saying such nice things about my show because it means a lot. Some days I really need that reassurance that like there is a point to me having to push through because trying to write something there funny. Is. When you feel like shit is very difficult sometimes.
I know.
So.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, thank you so much. But why don't you tell my listeners where they can find your show and anything more about you, whatever you want to share.
So if you want to listen to Legit Classics, it's on all the major providers. So you can find it on Apple and Spotify. And, you know, I've got a Linktree as well. So obviously I'm on social media. My little tag name is Legit Classicist or just Jasmine Elmer when you look me up on Instagram, Twitter, that sort of thing. Watch me on telly if you're in the UK, and if not the UK, National Geographic, the same program is on there, so go and enjoy that. That was about Pliny the Elder, in a wider episode about Herculaneum and new finds, so it was really awesome. Ooh. So it's lots of really cool, like, kind of brains turning into glass and stuff like that. So yeah. Hopefully, come see me there. It'd be nice to meet some new people on my, you know, listening to my show.
Yeah, well, I will link to everything in the episode's description so they can find it all. And yeah, everyone, please go listen to Jasmine's podcast because that's so much fun.
Thanks, darling.
Nerds, nerds, nerds. Gods, I love these conversations. They're fun for me, they're fun for you. We all get to learn a load of new things. Truly, such a thrill. It was so fun having Jasmine on to talk all things monsters and to share in my love for not only volcanoes, but the Chimera. Because who doesn't love a fire-breathing goat sticking off of a lion's back? Boring people. That's who. Thank you all for listening, as always. It's the best. You can follow Jasmine on Twitter and check out her podcast, Legit Classics, wherever you listen to this one. There's a link to her Twitter in this episode's description. And, well, I have a quick note about next week's episode, too. We're doing something a little different due to some scheduling things, but, well, you're going to love it, and I'm going to keep it to be a bit of a surprise. So just wait. We're going to finish off spooky season with a bang. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians. Honestly, Michaela handles so much. She is a lifesaver and is always taking on more, and she's the best decision I ever made, hiring that one. Stephanie Foley works to transcribe the podcast for YouTube captions and accessibility. The podcast is hosted and monetized by Acast. Help me continue bringing you the world of Greek mythology and the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron, where you'll get bonus episodes and more. Visit patreon.com/mythsbaby or check the link in this episode's description. You're all nerdy and cool. Thank you for being here. I am Liv, and I love this shit.
Do you love fashion? Do you love getting compliments on how well you're dressed? Are you always seeking the latest trends? Then we're talking to you. BostonProper.com is your fashion destination and the only place to go for all those nods, head turns, and new styles. No matter the day, season, or occasion, Boston Proper has what you're looking for. Sophisticated, confident clothing designed to flatter and get noticed. So visit BostonProper.com now and start creating your perfect wardrobe. Boston Proper. Wear it like no one else.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.com.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.